The Pentagon spends more than $1 billion a year cleaning up waste from its military operations all over the U.S., but that very waste could be a threat to public health. Here's ProPublica senior reporter Abram Lustgarten.
There's an entire process of storing, dumping, breaking down, disposing of, and in many cases actually burning all those weapons and weapons materials, and that's a third real major source of toxic pollution.
We've also have 2 months to go before the primaries. We'll get the latest in state politics with WBEZ Chicago's Dave McKinney. But first, we revisit our conversation with Dr. Aaron Carroll, who says that fad diets you love probably won't work in the long run.
All diets work about the same. You wind up losing some amount of weight in the short term. You feel great about it. Then it starts to slow down. And over the long run, most people will gain the weight back, sometimes gain even more.
That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. The latest news is next. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. If you kicked off the beginning of this month with some New Year's food resolutions, I hope they're going well. There's so many variations, right? Clean food, raw food, or maybe just less food. We wanted to revisit a conversation we had at the beginning of the new year with an expert on bad food, among other things. Dr. Aaron Carroll is the author of The Bad Food Bible, How and Why to Eat Sinfully. He's also a frequent contributor to the New York Times and a professor of pediatrics and the associate dean for research mentoring at Indiana University, where he joins us from. I started by asking him whether he was especially indulgent when it came to eating and drinking during the holiday season.
I would probably say yes. I just think I just let everything go.
I mean, that's probably where that's a very typical feeling that everybody has in January, right? That you kind of let everything go, maybe food-wise, financially-wise. And January is sort of that very depressing month where everything gets reined back in. Do you do food or diet New Year's resolutions?
No. See, that's the thing, is I just sort of go back to normal. Because I think I try in general to eat a reasonably healthy diet. So if I let it go for, a week or two in December, then I just go back to normal. I don't take any drastic behavior or big changes that are going to be hard to sustain, because what's the point? You're not going to be able to sustain them anyway.
Well, and I guess that's my question. As you go back to normal, I think a lot of people want to develop a healthy normal. And that's actually something I've thought a lot about this year in terms of developing a better healthy normal for me. So I guess my question is, how did you do that? How did you first, or maybe you've always been a pretty healthy person. How did you get...
No.
Okay, so no, tell me how you got to your healthy normal.
So it took years, to be very honest with you. This is a story that sort of, I would say, took God, like before I had children. So we're talking like 17, 18 years ago, probably when, my wife and I were first dating and then first married. We ate incredibly unhealthily. I was a resident at the time. Our lifestyle wasn't very healthy. We were both much heavier than we are today. And I think it took a series of successive changes because we kept trying to do the diet thing and that never worked. I remember trying Weight Watchers at one point and it worked for a while and then it didn't. And then I tried doing some heavy exercise at one point and it worked for a while and then it didn't. I tried going low carb at one point and it worked for a while and then it didn't. The problem with those kinds of diets or trying to do big deprivation is that it works. Everything works for a short period of time, but then it doesn't because your body snaps back and you just can't sustain it and your metabolism slows down. And so I think it was almost having children and then making a conscious decision that we were going to do more cooking at home. We were just going to be more mindful of what we were eating. I became a little more conscious about sort of processing in foods and trying to know exactly what I was eating, not in terms of chemicals or anything else, but in terms of how much has been done to the food before it gets to me, because it's in those kinds of decisions that I think too much gets into us. And again, it was just slow, steady change of trying to be more thoughtful and mindful about what I was eating that I think has made a difference in the long term. It was also an acceptance of like, look, my goal is not to be rail thin or some, perfection that doesn't exist. All of the research that exists on weight and exercise shows that, yes, there's a benefit to a point, but then then there's no more. You know, the idea of like just moderate exercise, 30 minutes a day for 5 days a week, that's where all the benefit lies. That's in like fast walking. Training for a marathon does not make you live longer. The same thing is with food. It's like you don't want to be overweight or obese, but the people that obsess about the last 5 to 10 pounds are just focusing on the wrong things. That is going to provide you no change in your health for the most part. And for the, you know, most people aren't even going to be able to see it. So you're driving yourself crazy over nothing. So when I say go back to normal, it's like, yeah, I probably gained a few pounds in December. I'll probably fluctuate that few pounds throughout the year. I've just learned not to care so much about it. It's not going to make any difference in my health. It's certainly not going to make any difference in my happiness.
Right. Those few pounds. And so we're speaking with Dr. Aaron Carroll. He's author of The Bad Food Bible. Most recently, he also teaches at Indiana University School of Medicine. We've been asking folks on social media to share their resolutions. You can tweet to us right now your resolutions as well at 21STShow. Dr. Carroll, when you said something that some of we've been asking folks on social media about, and we got some responses back on Facebook. Mary said her resolution was also to cook more meals at home as opposed to eating processed and restaurant foods. You said that. I mean, how important is that in terms of a lifestyle change?
I think that's the biggest change that you can make because when you cook for yourself, you're 100% sure of what's going into it. Again, this is not about chemicals or impurities. It's just you know what you're eating. When I make, you know, a vegetable at home, I know exactly what's in it. When a potato arrives in a restaurant covered with a sauce with 14 ingredients, I have no idea how much you're getting. And processing in general, even when we talk about food that's prepared for you at the market, is all about making it easier to get more of the stuff in than you otherwise would. Even, you know, nature intended you to get all the apple-y goodness of an apple from an apple. When you drink apple juice, that's processed. That is a way to get more apple-y stuff into you more easily. Bread is a great way to get grain and all kinds of ingredients into you much more easily. So when I say processed, I don't mean the industrialized sort of food that you think about with snacks. I mean anything where food, something's been done to the food before you get, it gets to you or before like you start to use it in your own cooking. And the more that you can stick to ingredients, the more that you can be sort of aware of what you're doing with it, probably the better off you're going to be. And no way allows you to do a better job of this than cooking at home, because that's how you can make the food taste the way that you want it to. It's how you can sort of be, you know, thoughtful about what you're putting into it and how much you're getting, and that's the way you can be really knowledgeable about what's going on. Besides the fact that, you know, there's just study after study after study shows us that you know, home cooking, family meals, eating with others, not only is going to increase your quality of life, but it's probably going to do, you know, more for your waistline and more for your health than almost anything else you're going to do.
Right. So when you say unprocessed, you just mean actual, or when you're saying ingredients, you mean actually fruits, vegetables, meat, the actual thing, as opposed to anything that's removed from that.
Even meat. I mean, it's like this is where people think an ingredient has to be like, you know, a vegetable. You know, a steak is an ingredient. You know, that's just they cut it and they send it to you. You know, most meats that you would buy, fish, chicken, pork, any of that is now bacon or something that's been processed is very different. But, you know, a pork chop is not really processed. You can get processed vegetables or unprocessed vegetables. You can get, you know, pasta is processed. There's just no way of getting around that. So the more that you can stick to unprocessed foods, the better. The more that you can stick to lightly processed foods over heavily processed foods, the better. Because all of that just allows you to be, you know, to maintain and be knowledgeable about what you're getting better. It's also just a recognition that processing, again, in general, is ways that we figured out to make it easier for us to consume more and to often get more than we actually want and or need.
Mm. So, Dr. Carroll, what is it then you think about the whole idea of New Year's resolutions or diets? Do you think it's just because we want a quick fix? Why does it? Because I think it's always tied to deprivation as well.
Yes. So two things. One is that we think that there is a quick and radical change to all of our problems. And as a physician, one of the rules of thumb I often give to patients, no matter what the issue is about as long as it's taken for a problem to develop, is about as long as you can expect it's going to go away. If you show up with 2 days of ear pain and an ear infection in a kid, I can make that go away in like 2 days. If you show up with a cough that's been going on for a week or two, the cold might linger, you might get a week or two. If you show up and say, I've been eating unhealthily and I've been overweight for 8 years, you're not fixing that in a month. That's just not going to happen. Certainly not in weeks. So, you know, sort of getting the mindset of like we're making changes for the rest of our lives that are going to be slow and steady, and our goal is sort of real lifestyle change. Those things are slow and gradual and take patience. And the problem with often deprivation and radical changes that center around New Year's resolutions are that they are just unsustainable because they're too difficult and too hard. And one of the reasons that I wrote the book and that I focus on this is because almost all the things that I talk about are things that people were saying, don't ever have this ever. It's poison. You know, it's going to be bad for you. If you just get rid of this, you're going to be fine. That's not how most human beings eat. It's not how most human beings think, and they can't stick to it. And it turns out there's not much science to support doing that kind of stuff anyway.
So let's talk about things you mentioned in the book that people often want to give up this time of year. And in particular, I want to go back to sugar, because you write about this in the Bad Food Bible. Does it matter what type of sugar we consume or avoid? Because, I mean, that's the one thing I think when we think about, I think you can make arguments, and we'll talk about it in a minute, about meat or salt, or you mentioned things like carbs and pasta. But what about sugar?
So, look, no one should be defending added sugar. The idea that we need to keep adding sweeteners, especially caloric sweeteners, to the stuff that we eat, which happens in a lot of processed foods, because that's how companies often make that stuff palatable. No one should defend that. It's not necessary. It has no nutritional evidence. There's nothing behind it. But the sugars that occur naturally in foods that we eat, be it fruits, be it whatever it is, those are fine. You know, with the idea that we have to make sure we have zero sugar or zero carbohydrates in our diet, there's not much evidence that shows that those kinds of diets are any, you know, superior in any way to any other kind of diet. And so the stuff that's occurring naturally is fine. The truth of the matter is that they're all sort of the same, too. Like all of this research which says that this sweetener is better than that sweetener, it's really on the margins if there's any difference at all. I would say try to limit your added sugars as much as you can. Again, you're talking about processing. But I wouldn't fret about, you know, making sure that you have zero sugar in your diet. A dessert is fine every once in a while. It's not going to break the bank in terms of calories or destroy a diet in any way.
And so what about like the whole idea of sugar versus, like, for example, corn syrup? Because there's so much advertising about it. Does your body turn all of this into the same thing, whether it's sugar or honey or stevia or whatever?
So, okay, so stevia is a little bit different because stevia is actually a sugar alcohol, and so that is different. But for the most part, all of the caloric sweeteners, at the end of the day, almost all of the good research we have says they're all about the same. You know, people freak out about the glycemic index of this food versus that food, or they say that honey is better than high fructose corn syrup, or it's different. I wrote about this also not only in the book but in the New York Times. But when they finally did like a head-to-head randomized controlled trial of like high fructose corn syrup versus honey versus
agave nectar,
sugar, and the truth of the matter is there was almost no difference in sort of the things they were measuring. Now, granted, the study was only a couple weeks long and they were looking at some labs, but there just isn't as much evidence for the idea that these things are different for you in any way. I would say all of them should be limited in the sense that they're just not necessary in most foods. They're often being added just to make other foods palatable that you wouldn't need anyway. You know, a little bit of sugar in your coffee is not going to make a difference in the long run. But huge amounts of sugar, like in soda, that's a ton of sugar. And if you drink a lot of soda, you're getting a lot of added sugars. There's a growing amount of evidence that that's not that good for us. And it's an empty nutrient. There's just really nothing in it beyond the sugar. So I try to limit my added sugars quite a bit, but I don't think that like you must do a complete elimination of any kind of carbohydrate or sugar in your diet in order to be healthy. That's just not true either.
And what about, to that point, what about alcohol? Because I think drinking, you mentioned soda, but alcohol is something that I think some people go on, especially in January, I'm not going to drink for the whole month of January. But what about, there's also studies about the benefits of red wine. We think about those sorts of things as well. Again, is your answer going to be alcohol in moderation?
Well, pretty much. But although I would say it's funny because almost all the reason that we say red wine has the benefits is because that's the alcohol that's the most studied. You know, it's not that they've done head-to-head trials of red wine versus bourbon and found that red wine is better. It's just that's the one that gets studied the most. Look, if you abuse alcohol and you need to drink less, I'm not going to encourage you to drink more. Alcohol abuse, alcohol misuse, horrific problem, results in tons of deaths and morbidity and mortality, totally bad. But light or moderate drinking, there's not a lot of evidence that says that's a terrible thing. In fact, you know, if you sort of weigh all the evidence together, there's arguably some potential benefit. And the same studies which can be used to say, oh, well, this alcohol is associated with this cancer, those same kinds of studies actually say, oh, yeah, but it's associated with an even bigger benefit with respect to heart disease and death, and that outweighs even the cancer risks. And I can't tell you how many times I've written about this. Here's the thing. You should be conscious of it in terms of you don't want to drink too much. You should be conscious of it in terms of, like, its calories like anything else. But I write in the book that I think you should treat all beverages with calories just like you'd treat alcohol. You can have it if you want it, but don't think that you need it. And probably in moderation, it absolutely can be part of a healthy diet.
Dr. Carroll, we just have about a minute before the break, but I want to ask you really quickly about, as you mentioned, studies. As we approach this new year, do you have a rule of thumb for people about advice about how they're consuming scientific information or data?
Yeah, I mean, the short answer is, I said, well, you should be reading me. I think that what you want is you want to look for people who write and talk about science who are willing to place everything in context, first of all. In other words, no new research should be read in a vacuum. It has to be weighed against all the research that comes before. Too often we approach a new study like it overturns everything that's ever existed before. That's a mistake. The second is that there's a hierarchy of research. Randomized controlled trials in human beings are the best. You know, cohort studies are probably next. Small studies of mice or things that take place in the lab, be careful about extrapolating them to human behavior. But too often, again, we'll take a small study of 8 genetically identical mice in a lab and say, oh my God, we figured out that all of a sudden that artificial sweeteners are worse for you than sugar. That's not how research works.
Okay, we're going to
do the kind of study.
Let me stop you for a second there. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to continue this conversation with Dr. Erin Carroll, author of The Bad Food Bible. You're listening to The 21st. Stay tuned. Thanks for listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. My guest is Dr. Erin Carroll. He's author of The Bad Food Bible. He also writes in The New York Times, as he was just saying before the break. You should be reading his writing, which we were talking about scientific studies and how to approach them in the new year. We're talking about New Year resolutions. You can tweet your New Year's resolutions to us at 21STShow. Dr. Carroll is also a professor of pediatrics. He also teaches at Indiana University School of Medicine, where he's on the line from. Dr. Carroll, you know, I wanted to ask, we've been, as I mentioned at the beginning of the conversation, we've been talking to different people on social media about their resolutions. We've kind of gone over with you how you feel about that and the whole idea of restrictions. I wanted to ask you, though, about there's sort of all of these different, I wanted to give you a chance to either bat down or discuss these different fad diets and things. And in particular, I feel like the big one now is Whole30. And I keep seeing all of these ads for, like, even the Blue Apron food delivery service, Whole30. I feel like I know a lot of friends who were like, Whole30, I just have to cut out dairy and gluten and beans and sugar. What are your thoughts about that?
So again, all diets work about the same. You wind up losing some amount of weight in the short term. You feel great about it. Then it starts to slow down. And over the long run, most people will gain the weight back, sometimes gain even more. And they probably that's because they always, you know, get you to change your behavior or become more thoughtful and mindful about what you're eating. You're consuming probably less than you did before. And for whatever reason, that's great. If I knock out gluten out of my diet, that means I'm not going to have bread. It means I'm not going to have pasta. It means I'm not going to have beer. It means, yes, it's probable if you knock all of those things out of your diet in the short term, you will probably lose weight. But then it'll slow down and then you'll probably rebound because eventually you will sway from that. You won't stick to it. The same would happen if you completely get rid of carbs. The same will happen if you go Whole 30. They are fine. And I'm not going to knock down anyone that finds a diet that works for them. I'm not trying to judge other people's behavior. If it works for you, that's great. But all of these sort of abstention diets don't work great in the long run because people just can't. I mean, the fact Whole 30, if I'm correct, is about 30 days, right? Am I correct about that?
Yes.
I mean, they're even
it's
like
just for 30 days.
And it's a short
right.
term. Right. It's like you're even recognizing, like, man, maybe you can stick to this for 30 days. That's infinitesimal in a lifetime. I would be much more interested in behavior change that you can make for decades.
Whole 365.
Or at least
that's what you want.
Yeah.
Yes.
Or for years. You know, that, and that's really what I've tried to do myself is just like I'm trying to cook more at home. I'm trying to, you know, eat more vegetables and try to learn how to cook vegetables better so that they taste good. I'm willing to make, you know, recognize that I have to season them with things like salt and fat in order to make the vegetables. I mean, that's why vegetables often taste good, but that's better for me. And so to not try to eliminate one thing, not to fall into the misunderstanding that somehow there's a problem or a devil where if I just make this one quick fix, it's all going to be okay. It's much more holistic than that. And I think that the people who try to make long-term sustainable changes are going to see much more success than trying to find a short-term quick fix.
To your point about vegetables, we had one Facebook commenter, Nicole, who said she was just going to eat beef once a month. She said for environmental reasons. We heard that from a couple people, people trying to do 2 vegetarian days a week for environmental reasons. Christina said that. Last time we spoke, I told you I'd given up beef and pork. So one of my resolutions is to just find better sources of vegetable protein to incorporate into my diet. Do you have any thoughts or tips on that?
So again, everything that I've said up until this point has been about health reasons. And when people have ethical reasons for eating certain foods or others, or environmental reasons for eating certain foods or others, great. I'm not arguing about that at all. You know, if you want to make an organic argument and you can point to the environment, that's fine. If you want to talk about GMOs and corporate misuse and policies and the ethics of all that, I'm more than willing to entertain that. There's not much health reasons to make those changes, though, and that's sort of what I sort of focus on. In other words, if you want to make those changes because you think it's better for the environment, I think that's awesome. My daughter, you know, is conscious about some foods that she will eat or not eat for ethical reasons, and I completely support her in that. But if you're doing it because you believe that somehow it's going to result in big changes in your health, that's when I would say, well, we really need to look at the evidence. And a lot of these abstentions or people that believe I have to eliminate this completely from my diet, it's going to make me healthier or live longer, that's where the evidence falls apart.
So one thing that you've said, one of our favorite questions that we normally ask you, actually, we didn't ask you this morning for soundcheck, is what did you have for breakfast this morning? And I wanted to ask you that because you were actually very famous for writing in the New York Times that breakfast wasn't really the most important meal of the day. So maybe is this a good time to ask? Did you have breakfast this morning?
Sure. I don't eat breakfast. It's just I never, and this is why I even wrote that column, was because I'm not hungry in the morning. I don't want to eat. First of all, I love breakfast food. Serve me breakfast for lunch, I'm thrilled. But I don't want to eat at 7 a.m. or 8 a.m. even. So I have a cup of coffee, and that's all I have until lunch. My oldest child is exactly the same. My other two kids can't leave the house without eating or they feel like they would starve to death. And my wife would try to force my oldest to eat breakfast, and I would stop her, and we would fight about this, which is why I even wrote that column, because there's no evidence for that. There's no evidence that breakfast is the most important meal of the day. A lot of the research, and I put that in quotes, you can't see that, that it's out there is funded by groups like the Quaker Oats Center of Excellence, so obviously conflicted. But there's no studies that show that people are healthier or that they do better. The research that people point to in schools that show that kids learn better when they get breakfast, almost all that research occurs in very poor areas where kids are hungry. And if we give them breakfast, of course hungry children will do better. That's not the same thing as saying that we should force a kid who isn't hungry to eat, or even an adult. So I all I've had so far today is a cup of coffee. I'll probably have a salad for lunch. And then I eat a reasonably big dinner. That's sort of what works for me. But people should find what works for them. And as long as it's healthy and they can stick to it, I think that's great.
Last question for you, Dr. Carroll. We've been talking about ourselves. You just mentioned your family. For parents, what do you think they should be doing in terms of kids? And especially I'm thinking about older children, about teenagers. What kind of things do you think we should be modeling for younger people in our lives?
Well, I think modeling is exactly what we should do. So first of all, it's like we shouldn't preach one thing and do another. That doesn't work. I also think it's important not to make food an issue. Don't fight about food. It's a terrible, you know, thing to start with the children, or start with a child, and then have them continue forever to be obsessed or panicked about food and their weight and everything else. I think the best thing you can do is try to introduce them to a wide variety of foods, lots of different kinds of foods, lots of different types of foods, lots of different ways of making food. My kids enjoy getting into the cooking, which I've been trying to do a lot more recently. But, you know, you want to expose them to vegetables, and you want to make vegetables taste good. Again, I'm often amazed at how people will focus on a main dish and put, you know, hours and like 20 different ingredients into it, but then think you can just boil some broccoli and you're all done. That's the reason no one likes broccoli. You know, if we spend as much time in the proper preparation and seasoning of vegetables as we do everything else, then the side dish wouldn't be an afterthought. And that's where, unfortunately, most of the vegetables and things that we would consider to be more healthy occur. So, you know, learning to cook better, modeling that kind of behavior, encouraging kids to eat tons of different kinds of foods, I think all of that's good.
Dr. Aaron Carroll is author of The Bad Food Bible. You can see his writings as well in the New York Times. He joins us from Indiana University School of Medicine, where he also teaches. Dr. Carroll, it's always great to have you here. Thanks so much for giving us some, I think, some maybe some healthy, rational kind of counter to all of the New Year's resolutions, right?
Thank you. I hope so. Anytime.
Travel to any state in the country, you'll be sure to find some kind of installation operated by the U.S. military or its contractors. These facilities are used for any number of things, whether it's for training active service members or for manufacturing and testing weapons. But many of these sites aren't safe, and getting rid of the toxic waste that comes from, say, producing bullets can be dangerous and expensive. The military actually spends more than $1 billion every year cleaning up waste from operations at more than 40,000 sites across the country. In Illinois, we have 120 of those, including 9 that are deemed high risk, including the Rock Island Arsenal and the Naval Weapons Industrial Reserve Plant in Decatur. That high-risk designation comes from ProPublica. The news organization has done a year-long deep dive into this issue, and most recently, their reporters put together an interactive map as part of the Bombs in Your Backyard investigative series. We just tweeted out a picture of what Illinois looks like. You can follow 21ST Show to see that. And links for the project, you can actually put your address in and see what's near to you. I'm joined now by one of the reporters on the series. Abram Lesgarden is a senior environmental reporter with ProPublica on the line from New York. Abram, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being here with me.
Hi there. Thanks for having me.
So there's a lot to get to, Abram, but I wanted to just start off by asking how many military-operated sites produce toxic waste, because it seems like this can happen in many different settings. But where is this coming from? I mean, even old military installations you guys reported that have been closed for years can still pose some health risks?
Yeah, so it basically comes from the entire life cycle of military activity. So producing, manufacturing the weapons, which includes the chemistry of making explosives and the factories that assemble those into bombs. Then those bombs, munitions, bullets, they're tested across the country on firing ranges and practice facilities. And then at the end of their life cycle, we have an enormous stockpile in the United States of weapons that were produced decades ago. They reach an expiration point where they can no longer be used, and then they need to be disposed of. And so there's an entire process of storing, dumping, breaking down, disposing of, and in many cases, actually burning all those weapons and weapons materials. And that's a third real major source of toxic pollution from defense activities.
Abram, who regulates this? How does this, is there specific laws for military toxic waste? and clean up?
Well, this is one of the most interesting things that we've found, and it's a consistent theme across five or six stories reported that the Department of Defense is supposed to be subject to the same environmental laws governed and regulated by the Environmental Protection Agency that any other industry in the United States is. But for decades, since the 1940s and definitely continuing until now, the Department of Defense has really pushed back against its oversight. It has in many cases explicitly defied EPA regulations. It's told state environmental regulators that it doesn't recognize their authority. It does endeavor to clean up its sites under these laws, and it tries to comply with state and federal hazardous waste laws. They're the same laws that apply to any other factory or industry. But it often does it at its own pace, or it pushes back against federally mandated schedules, or pushes back against the ultimate criteria or how clean a site needs to be in order to call it closed. It argues that sites are safe with a little bit of pollution when regulators say, no, that pollution might still cause cancer.
And so one example of how you write about this is what's called an open burn. And you all documented 61 active sites across the country where munitions are burned in open air. Why is that especially dangerous? As I imagine this is kind of what you're talking about, right, in terms of byproduct of burning things in open air?
Yeah, so this is a perfect example of the regulatory interaction as well. The Department of Defense has an enormous amount of waste. Some of it is munitions, and some of it is chemicals made from manufacturing of explosives, for example. And what they essentially do is they either blow it up in place out in a field, or they put it out in a pad like a big bonfire, and they light it on fire. And that's a process that most industries around the world used to practice until the 1960s, 1970s, when the nation realized that pollution was causing acid rain and making people sick and was really an enormous environmental problem, and passed laws that banned it pretty much for anybody except for the U.S. military. And so the Department of Defense has maintained an exemption since the mid-1980s that it still allows them to burn this toxic material out in the open air. And what's significant about it is that there's no pollution control whatsoever. There's no measurement of what's going into the air. There's no filters or controls the way you have on smokestacks to both put that smoke out of reach of people and also to scrub or filter what pollutants come out of it. And these sites are registered and permitted with the EPA, but they were permitted because in the 1980s, there wasn't really an alternative to getting rid of dangerous explosives. But in the years since then, plenty of alternatives have been developed. They're cost effective, they're safe, and most countries in Europe, for example, require them by law. And the Department of Defense of the United States still chooses not to use them.
So I know that there aren't any open burn sites in Illinois, but there are some that are close to our borders. One's in Middletown, Iowa. It's about an hour from Macomb. Another's in Southwest Indiana. And I know that in Illinois, there are 9 areas that ProPublica identified as sites defined as high and medium risk. Abram, I wanted to ask you, what is the role of state and local authorities in all of this? Do they have any authority to be cleaning things up?
Sure, they do. But let me just backtrack for one moment and describe that data and the data that classifies those sites in Illinois as high risk. That's data that we obtained from the Department of Defense. It's their categorization, and we published it. So that subjective analysis of what's a particularly dangerous site, that comes directly from the Pentagon.
Thanks for clarifying
not
that.
Not a judgment that we made. But sure, the EPA and the state regulatory agencies, they do have authority. Legally, technically, the Department of Defense and its agencies are subject to the same environmental laws that we all are, whether they push back against those or not. And it's the state regulatory agencies that ultimately implement those. So whether that's the Resource Conservation Recovery Act for hazardous waste or Superfund law or the Clean Water Act. It's the state agencies that have the responsibility to be to both write the permits that allow the processes that happen on these facilities and to go in and enforce them. And, you know, we didn't report in Illinois, but we did extensive reporting in Virginia, for example, working with the state agency there, and found, you know, on the most basic level that the state agency hadn't regularly inspected the facility that it was regulating, that it hadn't issued citations when there were clear violations that were documented in the paperwork. Not really investigative kind of techniques, but like clear violations that, you know, that everyone knew about, that still the U.S. Army in that case had never really faced any sort of repercussions for.
We have to take a break. When we come back, I just want to wrap with a couple quick questions here with ProPublica. We're talking to Abram Lustgarten. He's a senior environmental reporter with ProPublica about this series. It's called Bombs in Your Backyard. As we said, there's an interactive map they put together. We'll tweet that out if you want to put your address in. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. Thanks for tuning in to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. We are talking about military installation sites across the country and here in Illinois. There's 120 installation sites, and we've been talking about the waste that comes from them. ProPublica has been doing a deep dive investigation into this. All last year they did it. It's called Bombs in Your Backyard. Abram Lustgarten is with us from New York. He's a senior environmental reporter with ProPublica. I have to ask, Abram, how has this already affected people's lives? As we're talking about, you know, we were talking about open burn sites and potential toxins that are in the air. Who have you talked to? What have you learned about from local citizens who have these sites close to their communities?
Yeah, so, you know, one of the sort of scariest things about this whole project to me is that there's very little known about who it affects and how, and it's partly because it's been so poorly tracked and really not, you know, publicly discussed until now. You know, in many of these communities, including the site I mentioned in Radford, Virginia, where we studied an open burn site very closely, there are people in the community who think that they have illnesses that are unusual. They, in Virginia, it's thyroid disease, a very high incidence of thyroid cancers and thyroid diseases. And these, there is literature that ties these diseases to some of the specific toxins known to be in the smoke from the open burning, but there isn't research, epidemiological research, that can really pinpoint a precise blame or say that the Pentagon's pollution is the cause, and it's very difficult to actually do that. So what you just have is, you know, sort of a blanket of materials that we know are dangerous to people out in the environment, people who think that they might be sicker than usual, but no real way to make that link. And that's been a substantial problem. And on the other end of the spectrum, there are a few instances where there's very specific illness clusters. Many people are familiar, for example, with the Camp Lejeune problem, where there's a very high incidence of male breast cancer at Camp Lejeune, and it came from pollution in the drinking water on a base there. And it took years for the Pentagon to reverse denials that there was any kind of problem there and acknowledge that problem. And eventually they've paid several billion dollars to victims of the pollution in the drinking water there in North Carolina.
Well, and imagine it's even further complicated, because when you think about the military installations, how connected they are to towns they're a part of, as the employment centers, people working at plants that manufacture weapons. And then, of course, there's always sort of the civic pride that comes along with, for some people, of having a military installation in their community. Do you think that makes it further harder to hold officials accountable when there are safety violations?
Yeah, it does. Absolutely. I haven't necessarily seen that it affects enforcement, but it makes for a complicated emotional web around, you know, the public's feelings about these facilities. I mean, of course, you know, the defense facilities that we're talking about, they exist for an extraordinarily important purpose. They do protect the nation. They do make the materials that we use to go fight wars and keep our security. And that's always going to be a fundamental tension. And, you know, I spoke with the general counsel of the Navy for my last story, and he said, you know, explicitly that, you know, there's a trade-off, and we have made a decision to pollute vast parts of the country in exchange for, you know, for that national security. And to many people, that might be worth it. And, you know, and that is, you know, the trade-off that needs to be made. But many people weren't aware that bargain, so to speak, or, you know, that transaction had been made. And So, you know, just providing some basic information or transparency about what those risks are and giving people the choice and opportunity of, you know, how they want to live around these sites, whether they want their children in the schools adjacent to them, whether they want to push their state politicians to, you know, to enforce more strongly, I think is a you know, a valuable place to start.
As we've said, this is part of a ProPublica investigative series called Bombs in Your Backyard. They've created a map that pinpoints the location of every known military installation where some kind of toxic waste is being produced. You can search it based on your location. It also tells you which sites have cleanups scheduled, which ones have cleanups already finished, and which ones don't have any cleanups planned yet, including, as I was saying, I was looking at that one in Decatur earlier. Abram Lustgarten is a senior environmental reporter with ProPublica, part of this team. Abram, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thanks so much for your interest.
It's a busy week in politics, both state and national. There's, of course, the State of the Union address tomorrow. That's tomorrow evening here in Illinois. Governor Rauner is scheduled to deliver his version of that, the State of the State, the day after. Meanwhile, the primary campaign for both attorneys general and governor has gotten pretty contentious, especially on the Democratic side in Springfield. A state senator was cleared of sexual harassment charges. Lots going on. Dave McKinney has been following all of this. He's a political reporter with WBEZ Chicago. Hey, Dave, welcome back to the 21st.
Hey, good morning, Nala.
Good morning. So let's start with the Republican side of the primary for the race for governor. Governor Rauner, his challenger, his kind of surprise challenger in the primary, State Representative Jeannie Ives, are running against each other. They actually just met with the Chicago Tribune editorial board. That was right at 11 o'clock. Dave, did you have a chance to watch that? How'd it go?
Yeah, you know, it's still going on here. I think it's probably going to go for another half hour or so. And it predictably, it's gotten very contentious between the two of these people. And to my knowledge, this is the only moment where the two of them are going to be on the same platform anyplace. Ives has, you know, since this thing started about 45 minutes ago, has just been going after Rauner on, you know, his inability to get, you know, really any of his turnaround agenda passed, and instead his focus on social issues has been a, you know, problem to conservative Republicans. She's focused on House Bill 40, the bill that expanded abortion coverage to state employees and to the Medicaid program. And so it's gotten pretty nasty in this forum before the Chicago Tribune editorial board.
They're streaming that on Facebook Live. Not that I want to have anyone turn away from the 21st to watch it. You can watch it afterwards. But Dave, there isn't, it's just to underscore a point you just made, there's not any televised debates or there aren't any debates scheduled between the two of them.
Well, to my knowledge, no. I mean, and just as an example, I mean, here at WBEZ, we attempted to reach out to the governor's people. We wanted to schedule a forum with him and Representative Ives in partnership with the University of Chicago and with Politico, and we never heard back. And so, you know, I think Ives was willing to take the stage, but we never heard back from the governor. And so, you know, and I think this is, you know, this is a pretty typical page from the political playbook of anybody who believes that they are far enough ahead in a race where they don't really need to engage their opponent. And I think that there is a sense in the governor's camp that, you know, while Ives has got her following, she's basically more of an irritant to him at this point than anything else.
Right. I should make a note to our audience. We have been, and this is a good segue to talk about the attorney general race as well. The 21st has been interviewing all the candidates for attorney general, all 10 of them, as well as the gubernatorial candidates. The attorney general interviews, we're going to begin airing them on Wednesday. In the interest of fairness, we've recorded them so everyone gets sort of the same questions. We're going to start airing that. We're starting to record all of our gubernatorial interviews right now. So a note to our audience, if you have questions you want to ask the candidates for governor, you can email us. Our email address is talk@21stshow.org. You can leave us a voicemail. Our phone number is 217-300-2121. You can post on our Facebook page, search for the 21st, all of those ways. We've got some interesting questions about term limits and taxes already that we will be asking the candidates, but you are welcome to join in as well. Dave, let's ask him. Let me just switch to the Democratic side for governor and the primaries. A reminder to everybody, they're less than 2 months away now on March 20th. It's actually an open primary, right? So voters actually don't have to be part of any political party to participate, correct, Dave?
Well, I mean, the way the primary works, I mean, you have to pull either a Democratic or a Republican ballot to vote in either primary that you choose.
So you do have to pick a party ballot.
But you don't necessarily have to be registered with either party to pull those ballots.
Yeah, no, that's correct. I mean, you just have to be a registered voter to participate. You can pull either party ballot that you want to choose, you know, and vote that way. So the Democratic race, as you know, there are six candidates in that race. It's a wide open field. And we saw...
Yeah, they had their first televised debate last week as well. Mm-hmm. How did that go?
Absolutely. They came together. And, you know, and it was a similar situation where it seemed like everybody was going hard after J.B. Pritzker, who is... you know, up on television the most and has the biggest political fund. And, you know, I think while we don't have polling out there, I think there's a perception that he is perhaps a front runner. But the probably the most memorable thing out of the debate with the NBC affiliate here in Chicago, Channel 5, was, I would argue, was a gaffe by Christopher Kennedy. I mean, it was a sort of a softball question, which was, you know, name something.
Say something nice about one of your opponents, right? It's kind
opponents.
Of a standard debate and question, right, Dave?
It's a softball question, and it's one of those things where these candidates who go through debate preparation, almost, I mean, they should be prepared for this kind of thing. And I don't know what the situation was, but Kennedy seemed to be taken off guard with it a little bit. I mean, he had kind of an awkward moment. You know, this is after Pritzker was asked to say something nice about Kennedy and praised, you know, Kennedy's the Kennedy family's involvement with the Special Olympics, and it was a sort of an obligatory nod of the hat to the Kennedy family. And then when the tables turned, Kennedy was asked, and he basically came out swinging and called Pritzker the poster child for pay-to-play politics in Illinois, and that was it. And you know, afterwards he told reporters that you know he apologized to Pritzker for saying that, but it was sort of a self-inflicted wound that I think made certainly people watching that it was a little off-putting, I think, from people I've talked to about, well, why wouldn't you say something just, you know, something positive
just
about
say
somebody.
Something nice, right?
Mm-hmm. Right, pretty simple question.
Yeah, and then Dave, just there was also an attorney general. There was a Democratic attorney general's interview as well. I don't even know if there was enough room for all eight of them in the Chicago Tribune editorial board. How did that one go?
Well, yeah, you're right. I mean, the camera frame seemed to always be cutting off one of the candidates, Aaron Goldstein. But it was a deal again where I think most of the organizational support and money have gone to State Senator Kwame Raoul. And what you saw was a lot of the attacks being directed his way. I mean, there was some of the attacks also directed at former Governor Pat Quinn. But the attacks against Raoul were focused on his ties to the Cook County Assessor and Cook County Democratic Chairman Joe Berrios, and he had to kind of defend Berrios. You know, Berrios has been at the center of, you know, the property tax assessments in Chicago being stilted, I guess some would say, against you know, low income neighborhoods and very, you know, if you pay the right real estate attorney, you're able to get your property taxes reduced. People were coming hard after Raoul for his endorsement from Berrios' group. He was the only person who wasn't calling for Berrios' resignation. And so he was kind of challenged in that way. And one of the attacks against Quinn was, you know, hey, you couldn't beat Bruce Rauner in the last gubernatorial election. Why should the party entrust you to run for attorney general this time? So I think there was a sense, at least with those two, that they're you know, maybe ahead of the pack a little bit and are the targets here.
I wanted to ask you one. We just have a few minutes left, Dave, but I want to just end by talking about the Me Too movement in Springfield and just remind everybody, last fall, more than 100 women in state politics signed an open letter describing the pervasive culture of sexual harassment in Springfield. And in November, an activist named Denise Rothheimer said in a public hearing that she had been sexually harassed by Democratic State Senator Ira Silverstein. He was under investigation, but the story took a new turn late last week when he was cleared of sexual harassment by the new legislative inspector general, Julie Porter. Before we get to what the IG said, can you remind us exactly of what Senator Silverstein was accused of, Dave?
Well, I mean, there was a back and forth between Rothheimer and Silverstein in 2015 and 2016 that took the form of, you know, late night interactions over Facebook Messenger and early morning. They were just going back and forth. There were 400 some pages of this that Rothheimer released during this open committee hearing last fall. And it was at a time when Silverstein was carrying legislation on Rothheimer's account, and she really, really, in outing Silverstein, really kind of made him the face of the Me Too movement. I mean, he was the only named person that had with open accusations of sexual harassment. So that's what made this this move last week by Julie Porter significant, because it it cleared him of the major charges that he'd engaged in sexual harassment. I think Porter's main finding was that what he said was flirtatious, inappropriate. The idea of trying to determine if someone is a true blonde or not, I mean, that's a suggestive kind of statement that Silverstein made about Rothheimer in one of these messages.
Right. She said his behavior was, quote, unbecoming, but not necessarily doesn't necessarily rise to the level of sexual harassment. Dave, just a few seconds left. Just really quickly, what kind of reaction are we seeing from this?
Well, I mean, I think it's gonna come back to haunt him, perhaps, in his primary. He has at least, right now, four opponents, and I think this is going to be an issue that keeps coming up between now and March 20th.
That's WBEZ's Dave McKinney. He's a political reporter. Dave, thanks for being with us. I appreciate it.
Yep. Thank you for having me.
I'm afraid we're out of time for today. I'm Nyla Boodoo. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. You can always head to our website, 21stshow.org, to get in touch with us. Thanks for listening. Have a good day.